Matthew Bronson.
Welcome, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM here in the high desert of Placidas, New Mexico. And today on Conversations, we're going to be speaking about El Pueblo Health Services. This year is the 40th anniversary of El Pueblo Health Services in the heart of Bernalillo. And one of the original physicians, Dr. Alan Firestone, is with us today to share about that history. So welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Matthew.
I think the first sentence on the about on the elpueblohealth.org website is, rooted in our community since 1976, El Pueblo Health Services, Inc., provides comprehensive health family care to the residents of Sandoval County, the town of Bernalillo, and surrounding communities. That's
okay. That sums it up pretty well.
Okay. Is the interview over?
No.
Okay. So 40 years, that's an accomplishment in itself.
Yeah, because the history of medicine in Bernalillo pretty much was that someone would be there for a couple of years and then the clinic would close down, or someone would be there for a couple of years and then leave. So the fact that El Pueblo has been able to maintain continuity for 40 years is really unusual in what was, in 1976, a fairly rural setting.
Wouldn't it be more than fairly rural in 76? Only that I've noticed many of the things that I've come to enjoy about Placidas, like the beautiful library that we're in today, or the Merck Market. The library is, what, 2010? The Merck Market is celebrating 20 years. Yeah. So 40 years, was there?
There wasn't much here in Placidas. In Bernalillo, there was the mercantile and certainly the county offices and the school system. But not too much else. There were a few small family restaurants, and most of the people either did some farming and or ranching, or commuted into Albuquerque, or commuted up to Santa Fe. Okay.
And I recognize Bernalillo has been here for hundreds of years, so 40 isn't that much.
No.
But it did kind of take a jump forward over those 40 years.
Yeah. In terms of thinking about the rural nature of Bernalillo, in 1976, there were no emergency medical services in Sandoval County. Not even really the fire departments were geared to handle medical emergencies. There weren't any paramedics. If you needed an ambulance, you'd have to call to Albuquerque, and one would come out from Albuquerque.
Assuming you were still alive,
yeah.
Where would you go, or where would they take you?
Well, the nearest hospital was UNM and Presbyterian and St. Joseph's, and they were 20 miles down the road. But it might take you 45 minutes to get an ambulance out.
Sure. Well, there no cell phones.
No cell phones. No call forwarding.
Right.
No answering machines, and
it may have been difficult to find a payphone that was actually working.
There were more of them then than there are now.
Yes.
During those years, a lot of people just, if they fell and broke a leg, you know, they just go ahead and get loaded into the family car and hauled off down to Albuquerque. Heart attack, same thing. Because when time was crucial, when time was of the essence, you couldn't wait 45 minutes to get an ambulance out.
Again, on the website, it talks about it was formed by a group of committed community members and then, you know, became a nonprofit and all that. Are those people or families still around? Are they still involved with the...
Yeah, actually, Inez Gabaldon was on the Bernalillo Development Corporation, the BDC, and she, along with Lalo Torres, who was Jack Torres's father, and Lalo was mayor at the time, and someone from PNM, Larry Edwards, and several people from the community were working with a group out of St. Joseph's and Presbyterian hospitals who actually had a thing called cooperative healthcare services, which meant that they actually talked to each other and worked out, you know, which hospital would do neurosurgery and which hospital would do hearts and which hospital would do would focus on labor and delivery.
Be a master at your thing rather than okay at all of them.
Right. And at that time, almost all the doctors had privileges at both hospitals. And with that, you know, there was actually some cooperation. So the Southwest Cooperative Health Services and the Bernalillo Development Corporation got together, and they had a building sort of put together by some local developers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the original building for El Pueblo, but at that time, they went ahead and hired a doctor to work. And the first doctor was a surgeon who subsequently went down and practiced in the southeastern part of the state. But Edgar Roman was there for 2 years, and the clinic was open just 5 days a week from, you know, 9 to 5. And there was a sign on the door, go to the emergency room after hours.
Okay.
There was really no way to get in touch with anybody to get any medical advice or anything else. And Edgar was there for 2 years. And then an internist, Rod Cameron, came. And saw a pretty broad variety of patients, but it was not really geared into doing pediatrics and certainly not obstetrics or dealing with labor and delivery. And I really don't believe they followed their patients into the hospitals at that time. But there weren't any hospitalists. So
okay. Makes it easy.
Yeah. There was a one-year period where there was a guy named David Bryson, and he was Harvard-trained but really didn't fit in real well with the community, and the numbers of patients had really dropped off. Meanwhile, the Bernalillo Development Corporation, the BDC, began negotiations with the National Health Service Corps, which is part of the U.S. Public Health Service.
And for the folks who weren't around or still don't know, the Bernalillo Development Corporation, what are they? I mean, what were they doing 40 years ago that they got involved with developing a medical facility?
Well, I think their goal was just to try and provide more services for the Bernalillo area. It was like a chamber of commerce.
Okay.
Anyway, the National Health Service Corp, The goal was to go ahead and put physicians or mid-level practitioners like nurse practitioners and PAs, physician assistants, into areas which were not otherwise able to attract and support them. And initially, the Southwest Cooperative Health Services was involved in this, and then the BDC said, you know, gee, we don't need you guys if we're working with the feds, you know, so it was just one more middleman. And right. So Southwest Cooperative got out of it, and the feds were dealing directly with the Bernalillo Development Corporation. They had, I guess, one or two interested docs earlier in the fall of 1975. And then when I applied to the National Health Service Corps out of residency in North Carolina, the questionnaire covered all the areas where you wanted to be. And so I didn't list Region 6, which was where New Mexico is, because I really didn't want to go to Louisiana or Arkansas. And they called and said, how come you don't want to go, how come you didn't list our region? So, and they said, there are some nice places along the Rio Grande and up into northern New Mexico. And so I looked at the sites that were available and liked the idea of being in a rural area, but close to a metropolitan area in terms of having access to obstetrical care, because I knew that if we were going to have a second child, that it would be another cesarean section. So,
right.
So Bernalillo was rural enough to really interest me, but close enough to an area where we could get OB care,
as well as an okay place to raise a family.
Oh yeah. No, but most of the sites were really fairly interesting places to raise families.
But it's interesting that Region 6 spanned from Louisiana through New Mexico.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have been at that meeting, how they did that. Well, so that's back when government was government, or a different kind of government, where they were invested in bringing all these services to the entire country.
It was really a very good program, and being part of public health service, it served to allow you to do your government service as opposed to getting drafted into the army and sent to Vietnam.
That's a pretty easy choice, isn't it?
For me, it was. Yeah. We were out of Vietnam by the time I finished residency, but still. I figured I wanted to go ahead and try practicing in a rural area, and this was a really convenient method to do it without a huge financial commitment from me.
And you'd also already experienced the South in your residency,
yeah.
So a different kind of rural.
Yeah, and that was part of it, was to I was ready to get out of the South. So we came out and looked at the site in January. And liked it.
And El Pueblo was functioning at that point.
Oh no, okay. It was they were only open a couple days a week for just a few hours. Things were winding down with Dr. Bryson, and I guess completely shut down in about May of 1976. So basically, when we got out here at the beginning of July in 1976, what we had is essentially an empty clinic building. I think we may have still had a few tables, but the National Health Service Corps, as well as paying the physician's salary and nurse practitioner salary, also sent out, I think it was three or four 4 foot high boxes of equipment.
Okay.
So basically, it was fairly random. It was things like tonometers to measure eye pressure and
just whatever was laying around the warehouse.
And instruments and the Mayo stands, the instrument tables that extend over you during surgery and or procedures.
Right.
And, you know, a rolly stool to sit on and things like that.
In a case of tongue depressors?
Yeah. That's about it.
Wow.
So it was sort of what you needed to go ahead and open the doors. And so basically we had about a month to begin to get things set up and then open the doors the 1st of August in 1976.
And when you opened the doors, obviously there was a lot of preparation that went into that. Were there specific ailments or conditions that you were designed to treat? You know, was there a patient profile you were looking for?
No. Basically, the design was to go ahead and provide comprehensive primary care. So everything from dealing with pregnancies, labor, delivery, newborn care, childhood stuff, adolescence, injuries, sports injuries.
I would think farming community, you'd have a fair amount of things that needed to be fixed.
Oh, chainsaw injuries and things like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And on up through geriatrics, dealing with your 95-year-old grandfather, and then also taking care of inpatient hospital care, and you know, that could be everything from you've got a pneumonia to you had a heart attack and you're on the coronary care unit, and we basically took care of our own patients in the intensive care units and newborn nursery and assisted on surgeries and
then see patients at the clinic in between.
Yeah,
that's a long day.
And be available to go down to the office and sew somebody up at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday. And
isn't that when it always happens?
Well, you know, that those were in the days where there weren't urgent cares. There wasn't an emergency room close in. A lot of people did, might not have transportation down to Albuquerque. It might be difficult. And so we did a little bit of everything.
When you say we, it was yourself.
And the first nurse practitioner was Martha Burnett. Burnett. Who subsequently married the pharmacist, and she was with me for 2 years, and then Ken Pickard, physician assistant trained at Bowman Gray in North Carolina, came out and was with me for 5 years.
But so it was, medically, it was yourself and a nurse practitioner,
or physician assistant. For the first probably ten. About the first 12 or 13 years before we got another physician.
But there must have been a fair amount of office staff because this was pre-computer, so everything was hand done.
That's right. And we had a front desk person and a medical assistant and two providers, and that was what we needed. And
now at this point, you're seeing 5,000 patients a year. Year one, any idea how many was seen there, you know, the first couple of years?
Probably 25 to 30 patients a day for, maybe 40 patients a day between the two providers. And then around 10 to 12,000 visits a year. But
that workload seems somewhere between exciting and burnout.
Seeing 25 or 30 patients a day at that time, because of the documentation requirements and the amount of time spent on the telephone and stuff like that, was actually probably less time than seeing 20 patients a day now.
But still going down to the hospital and the ICU and...
Well, if that took an extra 2 hours a day... That 2 hours a day now is spent doing charting and dealing with insurances and phone calls. So,
right.
Would you rather spend your time?
Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad. The weeks were long. They were probably 80-hour weeks for the most part. But
Bernalillo is a rural farming and agricultural town area that El Pueblo would be servicing. You're the only real go-to guy for medical stuff. Did you ever get a call and say, hey, Dr. Firestone, my cow is calving. You need to come over right away.
No.
Never had any of those?
No, never had any of those.
Okay. It would have been a good story.
But I did get come quick, my neighbor's having a baby.
Okay.
And
did you ever get offered chickens for services or something like that? So it's the... four or five of you for 13 years.
Yeah. We gradually increased the additional staff to where we had someone in charge of some of the business aspects of it. The board of, you know, we started with a board of directors, a volunteer board of directors, and we still have a volunteer board of directors. And they were responsible for dealing with some of the business aspects, not necessarily the day-to-day aspects of billing and things like that, but making judgments about recruiting and salaries and helping with decisions about, you know, what evening hours to have and how to stay open and things like that.
I was looking at the website this morning, and I thought it was very interesting that there are four doctors, you know, quote unquote, but there are two nights a week that open till 8 p.m. That's community service.
Well, that and for many years we were open on Saturday morning or Saturday till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and that really took care of a lot of people who didn't have the ability to get in during regular hours because of work, where you can't take off work and come in because you lose pay for that time
and possibly your job depending on your boss.
Yeah.
What do you mean you're sick? As a community health service and part of the national program that built it all, sent you all that wonderful equipment, were you all employees of the Fed? Who signed your paycheck? Harry Truman or whoever was the president?
Not quite. But, I was a National Health Service Corps doc, which was active duty public health service, or active duty reserve public health service, and that was from 1976 to 1987. So okay. I had 11 years active duty public health service. Martha Burnett was active duty public health service. Ken Pickard was civil service, but what they started doing in the early Reagan years was they would have figured out a reimbursable rate so that for the first X number of dollars that you brought in, 10% of that would go back to the feds. After a certain point, then 20 or 30% would go back to the feds to offset your salary. And, you know, that, although that's very good in theory,
right.
The cash flows and stuff were tight enough that that really would have taken care of any reserve that we had built up and leave us in a position where you couldn't buy any equipment, you couldn't go ahead and hire somebody new, you couldn't deal with an emergency if the building needed a new roof, you know, you were out of luck.
But part of the being the National Health Service, weren't they providing you MRI machines and all that? You know, or at least
they the only thing that they provided was a salary.
But it sounds like a tough business model, especially in a rural area. How are you going to generate enough money to keep the thing going? Which I guess is an issue till today.
Well, it's always an issue, and. In the very early years, not that many people had insurance. And so when the HMOs came in, we thought this was a great blessing because more people would have insurance.
Right.
And then as the HMOs got pickier and pickier and put on more and more screws and tightened them, then it became not such a good thing.
Well, it was such a good idea that they weren't making enough money.
Yeah. So, or they didn't think they were making enough money.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of them were for-profit organizations.
747s are very expensive to maintain.
Yeah.
So you need that money.
But
Burgos Tumel Pueblo doesn't have its own jet.
No.
Or even Cessna. No. So it's you come out here, you and your colleagues are working at this 13 years. Were there times where it was like, I don't know, guys, if we're going to be able to open the doors next year or next month, did it ever get that close? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very, very definitely. And what happened was Ken Pickard, when he was working with us, when they quit paying his salary, when they said, okay, you got to get out of the National Health Service Corps, and we picked up his salary, we were also still being billed for reimbursable cost for him for the previous years.
Oh, wow.
So we were essentially paying for a provider that we were also paying ourselves.
Right. Well, and as a, you know, it's a harsh reality that healthcare is a business. Someone's got to get pay for it. Someone's got to make the money for it. It's not like a grocery store or something where you can do a BOGO. I mean, how do you generate more money, or how do you have a higher profit margin?
Well, there's no way to get a higher profit margin, basically. But the basic goal is to keep your costs fairly low and not provide services that are not needed, and try and do things in a very cost-effective method. And that really is served pretty well. But even so, when the National Health Service Corps pulled out of or quit placing providers in a lot of the rural clinics, one of the things that happened was that the state stepped in with the rural primary health care grants. And the RFCA grants basically allowed a lot of the community clinics to remain open after the feds pulled out personnel. Now, the National Health Service Corps didn't go away, but what happened was, and this happened with me, is initially they threatened to move me to Colfax, Louisiana, and it would have been a mandatory move, but I had quit taking the re-enlistment bonus about a year before that, so they couldn't do that. So they couldn't tell me where to go. You know, they could say, get out, or or continue with me in the same site. They eventually reached a point where they said, move or get out. And so I got out of the National Health Service Corps after 11 years. And at that point, we were able to go ahead and pick up my salary. And so my salary basically got paid by the office rather than the feds.
Right. And you never, as a physician, healthcare provider, said, I want to go make some of that big money?
No, why?
I don't know. Well, I mean, people do it, so
yeah, I know.
We'd have to ask them why, but
I know. But I don't need to drive a Cadillac, and I don't need to buy expensive jewelry, and I don't need to.
But aren't there some professional opportunities if you're at some of these? I don't want to say designer hospitals, but just hospitals that have a lot more money and more equipment, and so you get to do. I guess if you want to do research or experimentation.
On the other hand, if you want to do research, you can do it in a small office. You just have to think about, okay, how am I going to do this study?
Right.
So one study I thought about doing off and on for a while was, you know, plague is endemic. That's the Black Death, bubonic plague.
Right.
It's endemic in New Mexico. And there were years where we had 23 cases a year in the state, and some of them were fatal. And what I was curious about, since many of the cases appeared to be in people who were immunologically compromised, elderly, very young, alcoholic, was I wonder if other people get infected but fight it off. And so one way to do that would be to, you know, back in the old days, if you were going to get married, you had to have a blood test.
Sure.
Well, one of the things would be to look at antibody levels against plague in random blood tests being done for premarital exams. And, you know, that would have been a fairly easy study. And if you popped up with a few people who had antibody to plague but had never been clinically ill,
right?
You know, that would that might be very interesting. So there are ways to do research even in a small rural office.
And knowing nothing about this, I'll voice my opinion as always. I would think it's potentially a very rich demographic to do research on, because so much of the population have been here for hundreds of years, So you're getting a very select type of, you know, a purer than in maybe more of the metropolitan cities.
Well, if you look at the at very small populations that are that have been around for a while, in some of the areas like Sillay or Peña Blanca, have got a fairly restricted gene pool, and you'll see some inherited and familial disorders which will pop up in communities like that. And we do see that in New Mexico in the smaller and more remote communities. Now in Bernalillo and surrounding areas, there is a huge diversity of people. Old New Mexico families, new immigrant Mexican families, Native American, Anglo from all over, with you know, Polish ancestry and Russian and German and you know, and different a huge variety of demographic groups as far as retired military and people who came out to the Placidas area in the 60s and 70s and were living on the communes and
right.
Now retirees.
I was so curious how you got from a commune to be able to retire. That's
well, they usually, you know, usually if you worked on the commune, unless you went into real estate later on, which a lot sure. of them did.
Or Abby Hoffman became an attorney.
Yeah. Then you know, you're either always retired or there's not any possibility of retirement.
That's true. So how has El Pueblo survived for 40 years?
Well, I think one of the biggest things has been continuity. I was there for 37 years, and so that forms a stable environment where people know that there is always somebody who has their history and who knows what they've been going through,
which is huge.
And yeah. And then a lot of the other docs who have come on board have been trained with me in Bernalillo, so almost everybody over the years had some experience as a medical student or as a resident. And the working with UNM all these years has provided a ready source of physicians for us. And Stephen Hartman, who's medical director now, came out as a third-year student or fourth-year student and then as a resident. And we had identified very early that he fit in really well with just our general philosophy of medical care and got along with everybody. And so we were really excited to be able to get him to come on board when he joined us, I guess, 4 years ago now.
And you mentioned El Pueblo's attitude towards medical care, your philosophy. Is that something that you could explain that we would all understand or that would make it different than maybe some other clinics or hospitals? Philosophy?
Well, I think one of the things was to try to do as much stuff in-house as we could. So if somebody came in with a headache, the first response was not to order an MRI and send them to see a neurologist. It was to go ahead and sit down with them, do a good history, talk to them about things that were going on in their life, and then do a good physical exam, and then try a few things before making a decision to go ahead and refer somebody off.
Well, with the headache, isn't it the cliche, take two aspirin and call me in the morning?
Well, it's a cliche, but the thing is that, you know, there are those that are troublesome headaches and there are those that are sort of
worrisome.
There may be something in your life which is causing the headache, whether it's exposure to solvents where you're working doing painting in a closed shop or...
Right.
Or there's a lot of stress in your life right now between work and family and finances.
Living in today's world,
yeah,
apparently is very stressful. If we look at all of the, I don't know, is it the ACE inhibitors, the Prozac and all those that are rampant?
Yeah, but I think our philosophy was always to go ahead and spend as much time as a patient required in order to go ahead and get a pretty good overall viewpoint of what was going on in their lives and what was going on physically, rather than having as our underlying principle, you know, we've got to see seven patients an hour, and that means 4 minutes per patient. And so the we just philosophically, we've always gone ahead and stopped and taken as much time as was necessary.
Not to do a commercial or an endorsement of El Pueblo, but I'm a customer, and I have had two primary care physicians there, or medical providers, and I noticed from the very first time, it's like, why did they take so long with me? Was this the initial intake interview? But then after that, it was always, are you done? You know, do you have anything else you want to ask? As opposed to, you know, they're halfway out the door and go, the nurse will take you up front. And I wasn't special. It's not just me. It's everybody gets that treatment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's really a philosophical thing where it's not driven by how much money you need to bring in. It's driven by trying to provide care.
Oh, have there been any major events over the 40 years that we want to talk about, or is it just keeping the thing going?
Oh, you mean like the presidential visit?
Yes, like the presidential visit, the first President Clinton.
Well, that was really pretty interesting because that was around the time when the president and Hillary Clinton were looking at trying to make some changes in health planning. And it was the first effort to have a national initiative on trying to change how healthcare is provided and paid for. It wasn't very successful because it got blocked sort of by everybody, both Congress and I don't think the medical community was real receptive to it, in part because they felt like they were shut out of the planning phase. But so around that time, President Clinton was coming to New Mexico for a fundraiser, but also wanted to speak to the healthcare initiative. So one of his staffers got in touch with Tom from the range, and he was an old friend, and said, Tom, you know, do you know of a clinic we could go visit where the president could go ahead and spend some time and talk about the healthcare policies and still make it back to Albuquerque in time for the fundraiser?
Sure.
And Tom Fenton said, you know, sure, right here in Bernalillo. And so we'd always been one of the poster children for the state health office as far as clinics that they could bring people to show them what was going on in the clinics and what the state was doing. And so it was not unusual to have somebody from the State Department of Health to come down, bring somebody with them, and, you know, take a look at the clinic and talk to people. So on a Tuesday morning, somebody from the state health office showed up with a bunch of other people in tow and started talking to everybody. And, you know, they spent a bunch of time that morning. And I went into town to assist on some surgery at noon. And I came back out about 4:30 or so. And Shirley Lovato, who was my medical assistant, said, they're still here. And they were wandering all over the place, wanting to know who owned the property next door and who owned El Pueblo and you know.
That's what I was looking at. The Secret Service, did they like come in with the dogs and the metal detectors?
Well, not at that point. But at the end of the day, literally, not the phrase, but one of the guys came up to our office manager and handed her a card which said Secret Service Presidential Protection Unit and said, you know, I can't really tell you anything about what's going on. And about that same time, I got a call from somebody in the state saying, how come you didn't call the White House back? They're really not used to getting to having your phone calls ignored. And I went back and we had a bulletin board where, you know, lab results and phone calls that needed to be returned by the end of the day were posted. And in the middle of that, there was, let me find it in here real quick.
It's like, Al, call Bill.
No, it was Dr. Firestone, 250, Julia Moffitt from the White House, and the phone number, and please call back. And so one of our medical assistants had taken the message and thought it was a joke and just put it up there with the other messages.
Oh, great.
So I called her back and talked for about 20 minutes. And she said, I'll get back with you. And they called back and said, you know, that they would like to use El Pueblo for a site visit from President Clinton and on that Friday. And so they asked me to go ahead and give them a list of 10 or 20 people that might be have had either issues that were specific to rural areas as far as good health care, as far as problems with health care. And some of them would be invited to be part of the question and answer process. And so over the next few days, you know, there were people wandering around all over the place. It was great because there were all these guys showing up in trench coats.
Oh, Lord.
And we had to take them aside and say that, you know, really, you know, you're not being unobtrusive. Trench coat. The only people who wear trench coats in this area are the pachucos and vatos.
Which is, for those of us who don't know?
Oh, just the punks and hoods.
Okay.
And so they came in and you know, sort of did, you know, went through all of the scenarios of you know, trying to protect the president. So you know having us take the sharps containers off the walls because somebody could potentially grab you know, like a hypodermic needle or something.
Right.
And so it was really interesting. And also back in, you know, so as they were finishing up, I had them back in my office and I said, do you want to collect this too? And pulled out a, I think it was a 14-inch Bowie knife and I had on my desk drawer that I had taken off of a patient's wife who'd stabbed him with the, you know, 14-inch Bowie knife. And
survived.
Oh, he was heavy enough that it really it was
barely penetrated.
Yeah, it was really a superficial wound. But
wow. And who says rural health isn't fun?
But they said, no, we think we can see that. We don't consider it a risk. And then they came in with a bomb-sniffing dog, and we wanted to take the dog home because we got to play with it while they were still inside it.
I guess they know when they're working and not working.
Yeah.
And they're probably super smart dogs.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, the day of the presidential visit, you know, they had fences and barriers and metal detectors and everything else, and we were doing sort of our normal morning, and you know, one of the people I saw was a 11-year-old with moderately severe asthma, and we had given him breathing treatment, started him on a few things, but we wanted to see him back later that afternoon, so we gave him a note to try and get him through the security, and he was supposed to come back later in the afternoon for us to recheck him. he couldn't even get through the security.
Wow.
He couldn't get close enough to get in.
So when you're seeing patients, is the president there with you?
He came in and he met a few of the patients. We had just three or four patients that were there for the afternoon.
And did they just flip? It's like,
oh, yeah.
It's the president.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of them was being seen for his high blood pressure. Oh, needless to say,
didn't help.
It didn't help any.
Oh.
But
Well, that's a pretty exciting event.
Well, it was.
It's hard to follow.
Well, he then, you know, after doing the tour of the office, he then sat down and talked with us for about 20 or 30 minutes. And then next door where the post office is, they had set up a big, huge tent with a couple of bar stools and a hay bale in between. And and basically did a little bit of a speech about rural health issues and some question and answer, sort of town meeting forum. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they had a press conference for another 2 hours. So basically, he was in Bernalillo, I think, from about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon until about 6.
Wow, that's national, all those big, you know, satellite trucks out here. And
well, we had reporters from Phoenix and obviously Albuquerque. And we actually have got VCR tape of all the things that were going on the Albuquerque stations and the whole presentation, and then stuff that was on the Phoenix station. Somebody taped for me in Phoenix.
But it wasn't big enough deal for like whoever the equivalent of Katie Kirk or Matt Lauer was to come out?
No, I don't think we had national news service here.
Bummer. So in addition to seeing thousands and thousands of patients and keeping the doors open for 40 years, it wouldn't be 40 years without a celebration, which I understand is scheduled for September.
Scheduled for September 24th at the Rotary Park in Bernalillo from 12 until 4.
And the activities, pony rides and clowns and jolly jumpers? Or?
Well, there no jolly jumpers, but they're will be jugglers and maybe some face painting and some food and some music.
Okay, live entertainment?
Live entertainment.
Rotary Park's a great place.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be fun. So what is going to happen in the next 40 years?
That's a good question. You know, one of the things is right now with the Affordable Care Act, many more people who are poor who do not have, well, just lower income who do not have children have become eligible for Medicaid. So there's the number of uninsured has dropped tremendously. It's still being run through for-profit insurance companies, and the for-profit insurance companies have been continuing to jack up the rates on insurance and have been either dropping out of the pool of insurers for the Affordable Care Act or for Obamacare. Yeah.
And there's one of the biggies that dropped out, right?
Yeah. I think, well, Aetna wants to, I believe it's Aetna wants to go ahead and merge with Molina, and that's currently being blocked, and Aetna's threatening to go ahead and pull out unless they allow the merger. And so basically what's happening is that the for-profit insurance is trying to manipulate a lot of the care, and in addition, the way that the Medicare Part D was written for the medication and the pharmacy supplements, the federal government could not go ahead and negotiate prices on medications.
Right.
And now we're seeing some of the big pharma taking generic medications and raising the price, you know, 400%, 500%, 600%, or even more, and with no recourse. And so,
and there, the whole thing was in the news yesterday, the day before, about the EpiPens.
Yeah, yeah, going from what, $35 to $400.
Right.
Yeah, and so, what what that may force is a much more nationalized and single-payer system at some point.
So it's probably fair to say that with all of the churn, or just it's just been very chaotic for the last few years with the Affordable Care Act, little a affordable, going in, that it's, things are changing. It hasn't settled yet. Wherever we're going to be in 4 or 5 years is not what we have today.
Exactly. And also the electronic health record, which came in the last few years and was the sort of the last straw for me as far as driving me to retire, is going to become much more functional, much more usable, and demand less time, so that the problem that people have now with their doctor sitting there typing on the computer and looking at the computer instead of looking at them and talking to them, hopefully will improve, and providers will have to spend a lot less time charting and actually get a better note out of it, and that will really help providers quite a bit.
For people who are in med school or considering med school or finishing up their training, is there any kind of a movement towards working in smaller towns, community health, versus the big cachet hospitals or whatever?
Well, UNM has always had a focus on rural medicine, and it actually has been ranked as high as second in the nation as far as primary care and rural medicine training.
Right.
So that there's always some focus on trying to graduate medical students who will then go into primary care residencies and then go into underserved communities. Whether the underserved community is a small town out in the periphery of the state, you know, Raton or Lordsburg, or is an underserved community within Albuquerque. So South Valley, Southeast Heights.
Right. And, I mean, Bernalillo, it's a community health service over at El Pueblo. Would there be any reason for people, especially in Placitas, who are not necessarily the typical Bernalillian person, any reason to not consider El Pueblo as their primary care?
No,
or is it going to be better because it's small?
Well, I think it's better because it's small. It's in general, there's more access to the providers as far as getting a call through to them and getting a call back. We recently had a little bit of difficulty with some messages that were not going through. And
from the president?
No,
that, not that one.
and hopefully that's been taken care of. But the other thing is that the training of the physicians who are at the office now is excellent, and the skill set, the communication skills, intelligence and medical knowledge of our doctors and nurse practitioners are at least as good as any office in Albuquerque. So effectively, there's not any reason to go into town.
I've said that for so many reasons. But yeah, it's one of the things we spoke about that I think is a real plus is that there is no time limit. There is no quota system for the providers. We're here to provide a service.
Yep.
Some are fast, some are slow.
And the goal is to provide enough time for whatever the patient requires.
Would there be any particular health history that someone might have that you would say they're probably not suited for El Pueblo? It's too intense or too special or...
There's not anything specific. You know, we've worked hand in hand with UNM for dealing with some extremely complicated issues like treating hepatitis C. We were on the pretty much on the forefront of working with the with UNM's Project Echo in providing care for those patients with hepatitis C.
Are you going to outgrow the facility?
We may at some point.
Right now it's okay.
Right now we're doing okay, and actually we just finished paying off the building this past month.
Oh, well, congratulations. That's a big deal.
That is. It is.
And, I mean, I like it because it's convenient, plenty of parking. If I'm in a bind, I can do my laundry at the same time next door.
Yeah.
What could be better?
And one thing I wanted to you know, bring up and emphasize before we end, and that's that El Pueblo Health Services is a nonprofit, community-run office, primary health care office, with a volunteer community board. And the community board has been consistent over the years. Inez Gabaldon, who was on the Bernalillo Development Corporation board, stayed on our board until just about a year ago. So she has she had a 45-year history with us.
Just can't make a commitment. Huh?
Yeah, right. the board has ultimate responsibility for management of the office and for hiring the executive director, and but basically overseeing a lot of the not the minutiae of daily work, but the overall picture of where we want to head in the next few years.
Well, for this part of the conversation about El Pueblo Health Care Services 40th anniversary, this has been Matthew Bronson, and until next time, thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Matthew.